Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
If you're constantly on the hunt for a good deal, then you need Rakuten. Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop because members get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, traveling, dining, and more. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while you're doing it? It's a no-brainer. Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million members who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cash back really adds up.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 650.
Is there anything on the Nerdist community corkboard?
Hey, Chris, have you heard of that Mystery Science Theater 3000 show?
I'm familiar.
Well, a gentleman named Evan Ishmael is working on an album with Mary J. Pell from that show.
Wow.
If you go to maryjopell.bandcamp.com, it's an album called Songs in the Key of B-Movies.
Excellent.
And it's just her and this guy like rocking out singing songs about movies from Mystery Science Theater.
That sounds amazing.
That's why I picked that one.
I don't know why that's not in my life already. Got anything else?
I lost my phone today.
Where's your phone?
It's sitting in my house and I feel naked and alone and afraid.
Oh, you're going to be okay probably.
I hope so. Okay, here's the other one. Here, I'll make it a theme because this was the other one I was looking for.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to make it a twofer for Mystery Science Theater themes. Another fella out there named Chris, so you, wrote a book called The Galaxy of Mystery Science Theater, 12 Classic Episodes and the Movie They Can't Lampoon, or then the Movies They Lampoon. It's a guy breaking down the episodes and pointing out references and doing all sorts of fun stuff.
Fantastic.
It's like a it's like finding a nerdy thing and then figuring out a way to augment the already nerdy thing.
That is terrific. Just got an email from a young fellow by the name of Jeff Simons from Albany, New York. Hi, my name's Jeff. I wrote my first collection of short stories. It's called The Idiot of Genius Land. People can find it on Amazon, or people can contact me on the Twitters at HeyJeff, G-E-O-F-F, so the Joff spelling. Also, if people don't want to buy it, they can leave a ridiculous review of this book on Amazon. At the end of April, he'll be sending out 3 free books and prizes to the reviews he finds to be the funniest. I find this to be a fair and appropriate trade for funny reviews.
I'm going to say that I opened it up and just blood poured out.
Well, if you want to have your thing promoted on the Nerdist Community Corkboard and you're a person, not a big company, even if you're a small company.
Yeah.
But it'd be weird if it was like, hello, I'm Tony Viacom. Will you please promote all of my things?
Although my name's Dave Xbox.
It's pronounced Xbox. Then you can send us an email at events@nerdist.com. This episode is Brian Michael Bendis, who is a 5-time Eisner Award-winning comic book writer.
Can I point out a realization I had during this interview?
Sure.
I'm watching him. He's a man. He does not have the hair.
Yep.
And he has been trying to kill Spider-Man and Daredevil for many years now. He is the Kingpin.
You should have told him that.
I wished I could have said it because I had that moment.
Brian's a phenomenal writer and a good dude and someone that, because he doesn't live here, so are just trying to line our schedules up, but someone that I'd wanted on for a long time, and he did not disappoint.
Mm-mm.
Brian has Powers now, which is a show on the PlayStation Network. Also, his book Words for Pictures, The Art and Business of Writing Comics and Graphic Novels. Even if you're not interested in comics at all, I feel like this episode will still have things in it that you will enjoy. It's not just, I mean, I wouldn't be, if you're not a comic reader, I wouldn't be like, I'm not going to get anything this way. He's a great storyteller, and I think just the business of creation, he has a lot of good words to say about it.
He pushes a lot of the DIY, and that was really nice to hear from somebody who's that big and powerful.
And he does it very well. It's Brian Michael Bendis. Here's the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 650, with Brian Michael Bendis
on Comedy Central.
Good job, Kyles.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Microphone Unless for some reason you find yellow to be a disturbing color.
Well, like a Green Lantern is.
Oh, I got the green one.
This is the only room that joke would work in.
I'm the galaxy's police. What am I? I can only make a green microphone.
Remember the Batman and Robin All-Stars where they painted the entire room yellow? Like Batman and Robin just painted the whole room yellow and themselves.
And just smoke some cigarettes and
run, but
then take the shit out of Green Lantern.
Yeah.
That'd be a really shitty thing.
You could lose pee though.
Just cover his eyes. We have a birthday surprise.
I don't think you could. I feel like Batman's very hydrated. It's just going to come out clear.
At DC, by the way, that'd be just me having people pee on Green Lantern every. That'd be the event, the summer event. Infinite urine.
Green Lantern would not appreciate golden showers. Like that's the worst.
No,
that's one of the worst things.
Man's antithesis.
Maybe he just loves it, and that's what tortures him. It's a bummer. I really like it, but
the more asparagus you eat, the more it actually affects the outcome.
That's what broke up him and Ollie Queen.
Listen, there's a wealth of things that should be written down right now, but you don't write for DC, so it doesn't. It's not going to.
I pitched this.
They didn't go for it.
I think I'll be hearing back from you soon.
All right, guys.
It's been 18 years. I think this is. I think this
Green
is
Lantern gets peed on. Yeah. Okay, I know you're excited.
We bring in Aquaman. It's a whole water sports storyline.
But there's a twist.
But now that we're talking about it, I would like to see Jason Momoa pee on Ryan Reynolds. I mean, I don't know if that's weird.
I think I've seen that on Tumblr.
That must have happened at some point.
I think there's
a
Tumblr dedicated to that.
I'm sure there is.
That's a total Rule 34. That exists somewhere on the internet. Somewhere on the internet, Jason Momoa is peeing on Ryan Reynolds.
For sure.
You guys are probably reeling from the judgment that, guys, Blurred Lines ripped off Gotta Give It Up by Marvin Gaye, and they have to pay the Gaye estate $7.3 million.
Yep.
Is it just 7.3? I thought it was 17.3.
Well, the original suit, they were going for 25.
Yeah.
But apparently they got $7.3 million.
You ripped shit off. You got to pay for it.
Come on. Ray Parker Jr.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes, Huey Lewis.
Still undisclosed.
Still
but that's when
settlement.
You go, no, I'll just write a check. I'm not even going to argue with you.
I just want that to come out someday. Just... like after
it's
maybe after Huey dies
box
or the
with,
news decide.
It's in a box with the Harvey Keitel dailies from Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
We will never see them.
Never
happen.
Someone somewhere. The president is probably like Mr. President. Here, here's who shot Kennedy.
And
here's the footage of
here's what
Keitel,
the fuck Harvey Keitel did.
And here's how much
money Ray Parker Jr. had to pay Huey Lewis.
Holy shit!
All of it.
Like that's the thing that blows the president's mind. Mm-hmm. How much money Huey Lewis still gets just off that?
Well, that's the thing too. Like Jimmy Carter, he was like, as soon as I'm president, I'm gonna release all the UFO files. And then when he became president, he was like, I can't release the UFO files due to national security. Yeah. So, like, what the fuck did he see in there? Where he was like...
No, there's a website, actually, you can go to that shows the president the day before they take office. And then 3 weeks later, after they've been debriefed, and they literally turn white like they saw a ghost. Like, their hair turns gray. Like, there's an aging.
Oh, my God.
Of whoever pulls back the curtain and shows them whatever they're showing them, it's
probably like that speech from Men in Black where he's like that. We're always a minute away from getting blown out of the sky. Mm-hmm. It's just that people lead their happy lives because they don't know about it.
Yeah, the Matrix is real.
Yeah,
it is real.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine. And then not only that, but then the president just has to live out the rest of their lives. No, you can't unhear that stuff.
Yeah, you can. Yeah,
unless they deprogram them somehow, like when they leave office, like okay, all this shit that you knew, now we're gonna have to take some of it out of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why former presidents always seem a little wacky because
painting their own foot.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because they've had stuff, they've had their brain screwed with them. But they've had
now I paint dogs.
I paint dogs. I like to paint presidents as dogs. I think that would be amazing. I think if George Bush started painting presidents as dogs, like big.
Oh, he'll get there.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
Just give him a little.
Yeah, it's just.
Short run.
What's the in the comic book world? Speaking of essentially plagiarized material.
Yes.
There's only so many.
You come to the right place. Yeah.
There's only so many. There's only so many. That's I set that up in a negative way. I didn't mean it that way. There's only so many types of storylines and ways that you can mix and mash characters. At a certain point, what are the rules? I mean, I'm sure. You know, how can you tell? Like, okay, wait, this person definitely ripped this thing off from this. This came from this. This came from
this. It's tough. It is. We talk about it a lot because comics in general have a real mashup. It's a bastard medium. Like, there isn't one medium that makes comics comics. It's, you know, any kind of writing, any kind of art can be made into a comic. So you've got like line art and photography and, you know, digital and anything. And the writing, it could be screenwriting, it could be poetry, it could be, you know, purpley prose, it could be any of those things. So it's a mashup genre to start with. And then within it is all this like fertile imagination. So the good news is you get a lot of good stuff, like a lot, you know, a lot of stuff is tried, but, you do get a lot of stuff like, I like Bruce Lee movies. I'm going to do a Bruce Lee movie in my comic book, you know. So, and it's funny. Sometimes you'll see somebody will do like a comic that's clearly beholden to something. Like they love The Godfather. And then someone will rip off them a little bit in their whatever, their TV show. And our friends will go, oh, my God, can you believe they ripped me off? They mean your rip off of The Godfather? You know, it's the circle of life.
They ripped you off before you wrote your thing.
It's the circle of hack.
Yeah.
But you do. You just sit there and you go, you look through stuff and go, you want to make books that you would buy. You know, that's like the number one rule for us. Like, would I buy this if my name wasn't on it? If I was going to store, would I buy this? But at the same time, you want it to be a new thing. Not you'll just buy it because it's like that thing you like. So you got to put it through, you know, you got to be honest with yourself. You got to really look in the mirror and say, is this a real new thing or is, you know.
Well, like,
and then on top of that, John Cleese told a story and he's like one of my heroes, right? Because he's so serious and, you know, he told a story about how he wrote a whole sketch for Monty Python. He was sitting in his office, he typed up the whole sketch. And when he got to the end of it, he realized that he wasn't creating. He was remembering a sketch from the Goon Show. And it was only when he was done did he read it back. Oh, I saw this sketch. Peter Sellers did this sketch. I'm like, and that freaked me out. Now every time I think of a new idea, like for Avengers, I go, did Roy Thomas do that? Like I have to call people and go, am I remembering this or did I think of it?
Sort of like leads into my question of like, so when you take over, like, and they're like, okay, Spider-Man, you do the Ultimate Spider-Man, and then do you then have to go, okay, and do you have to go back and go, well, I need to look at every storyline that Spider-Man's done over 400
issues? Well, that's a little easier because you're adapting.
Yeah.
The job is to take this thing and, you know, freshen it up. And so there you just look at it and go, well, it's not broken.
Yeah.
So there's nothing to fix.
Yeah.
It's just telling the story. And I've told this before. It's like I looked at it like Shakespeare. You adapt a Shakespeare play. You put it in a new setting. You know, they put Hamlet in New York once, you know. But the truth of the piece doesn't change. The language of the piece doesn't change.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then I read one interview where Stan Lee said the only reason the origin of Spider-Man is 11 pages long is because that's all he had. And I was given like as many issues as I wanted. And I said he wanted to take this for a ride if he was allowed to. So they kind of emboldened me to like, I will do what he wanted.
Yeah.
And but
that's why it was so interesting that the origin story of Miles Morales is like a frame, basically. It's just like he goes to his uncle's place and like, I got bit by a spider. I got powers.
No, but there's a lot of build up.
Yeah, I know.
But
I feel like at that point it didn't really bother me because I'm like, yeah, we know this is how Spider-Man's created, so let's just get into the good stuff.
No, we want to get to it. Yeah, and also like you grow as a writer.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't, you know, just because you can't take 100 issues doesn't mean you have to take 100 issues. But
you did it in like 8, right? How many issues did you do it in?
Ultimate Spider-Man's origin was 7.
7 issues.
So, yeah. So it's about like 120 pages or something of an origin.
It's kind of kind of a scary medium in the sense that, you know, if you're a band or you're a comic or there's so many other mediums where you can go workshop stuff, but it's not like you can't really workshop a comic.
Well, you can and you can't. I mean, it depends. Like, a lot of time you are doing it whether you realize it or not. You know, like, it's like you have to make one every month. So we'll make this one and we'll make the other one better than this one. And so there's a version of that. But yeah, but the audience expects a lot and they're right because they're expensive and you should be giving them everything you have. So you can workshop privately. Like you can do like exercises and there's a lot of sketch work and a lot of conversation between writer and artist where we do workshop it out. And then we have, you know, if we're working mainstream, we have like a nice infrastructure of people to bounce ideas off of. So it does get workshopped. So
But you must have like a close circle of good comic friends. You're like, can you check this out?
And
you
see, yeah, I'm very lucky. I live in Portland, Oregon, where everyone in comics to live. Where it's mandatory that you live here.
Yep.
And like every Friday night, we host like a dinner, just because if we don't make an, we're such shut-ins that if we don't make an effort, we'll just never see each other again.
Right.
You'll see
each other at the next con.
I got a PlayStation and a bottle of water. What do I need the world for? So Matt Fraction and Kelly Sue were family, and Greg Rucka and David Marquez, who did Ultimate Spider-Man, lives in Portland, and Mike Oeming, who I do Powers with, lives in Portland. So there's so many others, and we get together, and we just moved Kevin Maguire to Portland, so everyone comes to visit us and then they stay. It's great.
I get it. You know, it's like the weather's just bad enough to keep you inside and working.
But no, it's kind of like hype a little bit. Seattle's
way worse weather-wise.
Portland, instead of snow, we get rain.
Right.
And most of us lived in Cleveland or New Jersey. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And
there
like, you know, like all my friends in New York were like shut in. Like my editors couldn't get to work last week.
Right.
And I was riding my bike. And I was like, felt bad. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, but it,
yeah, you're from Cleveland.
Yeah, I'm from Cleveland. We had lake effect wind. We had like 33 below zero. I'm a bike rider. I'll take a little misty rain a couple of months a year.
It's not that bad.
It's fine.
Yeah, I spent probably 3 or 4 New Year's in Portland just because I just like the town.
Yeah, and it's also just very open-minded. Everyone just does whatever they want and is creative and just expressing themselves individually. And no one cares who you're married to, and no one cares what your family looks like. It's just everyone, you know. And it's only when I leave Portland do I
realize that those families are really
close. I have a multiracial family. I have like 2 kids are African American, and we're just crazy. We're just crazy. And no one gives us a second look in Portland,
right.
But we went to Florida and people were like the fucking monsters.
Really?
Yeah, unbelievable.
Well,
we went to Tokyo and I didn't realize the racism that was in Tokyo. I just was unaware of it.
Uh-huh.
And some old woman just came up to my little daughter and yelled Negro in her face.
Oh my God.
Like she was like 3 years old. She was Negro. I was like, whoa. Yeah.
Did she mean it that way, or was that just the only English word she knows?
It doesn't matter.
One of her Japanese friends was like, this is how you say hi in English. And then she was just trying to fuck with her.
Later in the trip, someone showed me a store at a mall in Tokyo that was filled with like Sambo racist figures
boy.
And stuff.
Okay, maybe
that's all they had. And it was a store. And they sold enough of it to stay open in a mall.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, I was like, wow, yeah.
Jesus
and
Christ.
And I know it's not everybody. I know it's not everybody. But, wow. When you see the store, you're like, Jesus.
And there were, you know, I don't know why I'm going to go off on this tangent, but it just reminded me that the other night I was talking to my girlfriend about, she was not aware that there are old Looney Tunes that are super racist, I mean, that have been banned. Mm-hmm. And we watched the one that they did of Snow White was called Coal Black. Mm-hmm. And it's really
fucked
up.
I can take it back to Nerdtown for you, because we just celebrated Will Eisner Week this week. And if you watch this amazing documentary about Will Eisner that just came out a couple years ago, they talk about he had some racist stuff in the spirit. There was a character who was a racist caricature. And Will Eisner was such a forward-thinking like genius that he revisits it. Like, why did I do this? Like, I just wasn't aware of how bad this was until he went to the army and stuff. And then later in his life, he did a whole graphic novel called Fagin the Jew about the anti-Semitic stereotype in Oliver Twist. Literally, you try to figure out how does a smart person not see this,
right?
You know, and so it's fascinating.
I mean, I think you know, with stuff like that, I think it's one of those things where people just never think about it because they automatically go, "Oh, that's a classic." I mean, of course, why would a classic?
Yeah,
because you're not looking at it like if it came out today, you'd be like, you know, that character. I don't know about that.
Yeah,
you know?
And to be fair, he built the character into something special, but its origins and the look of it is, yeah.
And it's and I mean, not only is racism, not only the offensive part, yes, but also just hacky. I mean, it's just hacky.
Yeah, I just if you need evidence of what the world was like, you know what I mean? And you see it and stuff like that, you go, Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were from Cleveland.
Yes.
And when did you get out of Cleveland?
September 11th, 2001. Great.
Wait, what?
Gay day to travel.
Wow, that's the best day in the world. That was the best day to travel.
Yeah. And but I lived there for years. I absolutely loved it. I just returned for the first time last year, did a TED Talk, and just, you know, just filled with nostalgia.
How was your TED Talk?
It's scary. It's scary, dude.
It is scary.
Have you done one?
No, I haven't done one.
It's scary because, like, I like this. We're talking. You know, we talk about whatever we're thinking about, and we do panels or like that, right? But TED Talk is a 25-minute performance.
Oh, I thought it was 15.
It ended up being 25. Okay. And everyone ends up being 25. But
you're on the hook for 15 minutes?
Yeah, but you have one take, and you're working to an AV thing behind you, and you better get it done. Yeah, so it was
because that's going to live forever on the TED site,
and it's a different set of muscles than I use. So I was terrified, but it worked out.
What was your TED Talk about?
Me? No, it was what they're all about. No,
hey guys, what do I like? That would be hilarious.
Mine was about they wanted us to talk about. There was a specific theme of the night, and they were talking about your environment affecting your dreams. You know, you want something outside of where you grew up, and it was right. You know, we're in Cleveland, and I would read the little boxes in the comic books, and as soon as I was old enough to realize there were people made these. Like, I wanted to see my name there, right? And that the journey in Cleveland, like, how – and it was before the internet and before – like, how do you do that? How do I get from here to there? And it was just talking about that and, you know, Walt Simonson being so cool to me when I was a kid and stuff like that, you know. My goal really is just embarrass Walt Simonson in every medium I can find because he was nice to me for 5 minutes when I was 12 years old. But, so it's just to talk about that and just talk about – because that it is the thing that I get asked the most about. It's that I want to make comics for a living.
Of course.
What? How do I get from here to there? I just can't. You can't even find the road, you know. And it's so much easier now than it was. And so But I try to teach by example. Like I was you. I was you without the internet. So you can do it. And listen, if I can do it, seriously, you can do this. So.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine the path was a little more direct. I assume pre-internet. Well, you know. You'd send in your work to someone or have someone look at it or you.
No, it ended up being you go make a comic book. Go make a comic book and then make another one and make another one and get good at it. And either do it with your friends or do it by yourself. But if you want to be in comics, make a comic book and poof, you're in comics. That's it. There's no moat.
You just do it.
You just do it and you're in comics. And then, hey, guess what? You can also use these comics as your like calling card. Hey, Marvel and DC, look what I can do. And every single person that I know in comics broke in this way, whether they intended to or not. You know, people come to conventions and they bring their portfolio and they try to get attention. That's one way to do it. But most people just said, F it. Are we willing to swear?
You can say whatever you want.
And they go, fuck it. I'm going to make a comic book. Because who's going to wait around for, you know, some dude, assistant editor to discover you? Or I'm going to make comics before I keel over. And then they become the other thing that you need.
And like you said, now you can just do them and put them online.
Boom. Yeah, Tumblr. Marvel's discovering people off of Tumblr. They're looking. Wow. They're there looking.
I mean, I found an old folder of mine when I was a kid, which, you know.
You come in that folder?
What?
You come in that folder?
Could you come all over that folder? Probably.
I just asked if I could swear.
Just waited 2 seconds.
I had that classic you know how to draw the Marvel you know like
no
the,
I had it too yeah. I carried around like the Bible
yeah I have a folder with all these like oh here's me drawing Doctor Strange and here's me drawing Daredevil and you know it's like I liked much more cartoony stuff and so comic book art wasn't really it wasn't totally in my wheelhouse
right
because I was more of a child of Warner Brothers cartoons and I like that. I like that. I was more of a Chuck Jones fanatic.
And they're equally hard to do.
Yes.
If you want to master it. They're both equally hard for their own reasons. Absolutely. And there was also the Marvel tryout contest book. There was the
it came, remember yeah.
that? It was, you know who won the contest?
Who?
Mark Bagley. And I was teaching art in a summer camp, and I found out he won, and I must have submitted like 18 things, and I was like, curse you, whoever you are, Mark Bagley. Cut to like 15 years later, you know, 200 issues later. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you teaching in Portland right now?
I teach at Portland State University. They just started a comics studies program.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So you can get a degree. You can get, you know, and this semester is like the best class I've had. And that's what the book is an offshoot of. Like I arranged all of my theories and thoughts.
You're saying you wrote this book to make your students buy it?
Yes. Only he's missing. If I could be one of those guys who, like, you remember that? And next we'll be reading Faber on Faber. I'm Professor Faber. And you'll be reading. That's from the, was that, freshman? I think it was freshman, yeah. So.
But I think you are kind enough to only charge $24.99.
Yes. Well, yeah, exactly. No, in my class, I use the Portland comic community, and I have tons of guest lecturers come
in. Oh, that's
in
awesome.
Because, you know, the thing is, there's no right or wrong way to do it. There's no right or – there's no – you know, in screenwriting, there's a format, and you hold to the format or you're wrong.
Yeah, save the cat.
Yeah, you know, but even the look of it has – sure. You know, and in comics, there's no such thing. There's no format. So there's people – it's great because you can find your own way. But it's frustrating if you're trying to figure out how to write them for a living. There's no, like, there's no Robert McKee. You know what I mean? And so I show here's a bunch of different writers and a different bunch of different collaborators, and they're all going to tell you their story and philosophy, and you're going to pick the one that you think most applies to you. So that, you know, and that's the theory.
That's
of
great.
It.
Well, that, like, actually, them to, you know, because my first question would be like, well, if you just have to do it, why do you need to go to class for it? But hearing that it's that kind of a deep dive of here's a pantheon of brilliant writers and artists. And
no, and it's also, you know, but there's basics that you should know just as a storyteller, like tell your story clearly.
Right.
The page, like, you know, your comic book page, it has real estate. There's real estate on the page. There's almost so much stuff you can cram on it.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, that's the mistake you always see. Like, even comics that are published, yeah, like, there's the word balloon shoving the guy's, covering the guy's face. That's a badly made comic. The page.
Not only that, but then you have the word balloons and the internal monologue.
Yeah, yeah, and overwritten or just badly designed. You can have a million words on the page, but if they're designed well. Uh-huh. With the art, it's all in cahoots. So just teaching them that and teaching the basics of storytelling and act structure and, you know, themes and, you know, all that, all the basic stuff that you would teach in any writing class, but applying them directly to the magic of the comic book page. The invisible art, as Scott McCloud, of the spaces in between the panels and how you can control them.
Can you write for a character that you don't like?
Yes. You don't have to like them, but I'm empathize with their place in the world. Like, I don't think I'd hang out with Scott Summers, but
that's the thing. No one would hang out with Scott Summers.
Scott Summers.
No one only
dates redheads. So I don't think anybody
is going near Scott Summers.
No, but I empathize with him tremendously, and I love writing him.
Do you know when I was a kid, I was for some reason Cyclops was my favorite. Well, I guess he was the leader of the X-Men, but then what turned me off to Cyclops was the realization that he often will miss, but he's shooting with his fucking eyes. Like, how do you miss with your goddamn eyes?
No, but what I like about him and I like about, like, Captain America is that when we were kids, they were the characters that would only have, like, little fitful bursts of interestingness. They were the most vanilla. Like, he was kind of like the most vanilla X-Men, and now he's the most controversial X-Men. Like, there's nothing you can do with him without half the internet screaming at you. And it's fantastic. I love that about it. When you figure that game out, it gets really exciting.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, yeah. But, like, so you don't have to like them, but you have to look at, you know, like Magneto is, like, the best villain because his point of view is correct. I mean, he has a point of view. I wouldn't say correct, but it's arguable.
Right.
Like, you can go, I see why you think that.
Yes.
And there's a lot of evidence to support your theory. What you're doing about it is incorrect.
Right.
But, you know, when you see those Magneto is right t-shirts, they're talking about, he ain't wrong.
Right.
Yeah. if given a chance, everyone would round anybody up, you know. So
how much leeway do you have when you come in with a character? Like, how much do you go, well, I have to, you know, there has to be this much canon, or I don't have to worry about canon, or I can do, you know, like, how far can you spin a character off in your own direction?
I have an editor, Tom Brevoort, is a name you've probably seen in the comics, and he has an excellent quote that continuity is a tool of storytelling like any others, and it can be abused or it can be used beautifully. And when people are abusing it, they're, like, either leaning on old stories, or they're retelling old stories, or they're like, hey, remember the Days of Future Past? I'm going to do that again.
A flashback episode. Yeah. Spider-Man's trapped in an elevator.
Happens all the time where you see, like, the full page, like, flashback. They used to do that a lot. They don't do it anymore, but, like, you'd see, like, every time Ultron showed up, here's everything Ultron ever did or said in the whole page. And you're literally, like, eating up one of your pages, doing a greatest hits package. And it served its purpose more before there was like a recap page. I got it. But, you know, like Garth Ennis' quote about that was like, evil robot, move on. If I need to know more, I'll go find out more. There's you know, there's boxes full of comics in stores. I can go find them.
Are we in a golden age of superhero movies, or is it a bubble that you think is going to burst?
It's not a bubble.
Good.
No, I mean, people talk about the bubble since the second X-Men movie.
Right, you've been there the whole time, so you know.
What we're seeing now is, and some people won't agree with me, but I know I'm right, is in comics, there is some creators that have struggled to find mainstream acceptance, so they piss all over everything mainstream.
Sure.
But really, if DC called tomorrow and said, you can write Superman, okay.
Right.
You know, and so there's that, right? And we're seeing the film version of that go on right now, where every time someone wins an award, they get up and go, fuck superhero movies, right?
James Gunn wrote a great response.
Did he do it?
He wrote a response and posted on Facebook all about, like, you know, you can't tell me that you care more about your thing than that I care about my thing.
Ridiculous.
Like, I put as much work into the characters as...
No, but even more so, I would tell you that 9 out of 10 times those persons are actively looking for work at Warner Brothers or Marvel doing those books. So I've seen this because this happens in comics too, where they want to write Batman. They can't write Batman, so fuck Batman. But it's disingenuous. Some people really are like, fuck Batman. But there, some others are just wildly disingenuous. And I've been shown some way out there creators who really scream so much you'd remember it. And then at the same time, they have a pitch in. And they think screaming, yelling, fuck you, Marvel, is going to get Marvel's attention. You know,
it does the wrong kind of attention.
They never call. They never go, do you really want me to go fuck myself, or do you really like me? And you're just saying fuck me. But that's what it is. So we're getting the movie version of that right now. So that little bit of media backlash,
yeah,
is literally guys, filmmakers going, fuck you, superheroes, and meanwhile they're in line to direct, you know, Justice League or something.
I just tend to think that, I mean, you know, this is a conversation that I've had many times with people. It's like, you know, there's a certain type of proto nerd who's like, it's like pop culture now, and Comic-Con's it just used to be comics and now it's movies. And it's like, hey, you know, it's good for everyone the more people you can pull in. So if there's more comic book stuff out in the world than movie forward, like, it gets more, maybe a kid's going to start reading comics because, oh, I saw this, you know, Daredevil on Netflix, you know, whatever. And
Guardians, for sure. I've actually felt it on Guardians in a way I didn't even feel it when I was on Avengers when the Avengers movie came out.
Yeah.
But on Guardians, like, I felt my kids' friends, like, Guardians will make them read.
You could
write a philosophy philosophy paper on why. Like, you never figure out why the talking raccoon with the gun is the thing that's going to get kids, like, but yeah, it's fascinating. Which things?
What do you mean you can't figure out why? It's a talking raccoon with a gun.
No, but like,
kids love.
Why not Hulk punching Thor in the face? Like,
sure.
I get. Listen, I was one of those kids. Something I saw made me go, I'm going to read these forever. So I get it, but it's interesting how the Guardians definitely inspired an imagination, a la when we were kids, Star Wars did to us. We would just sit there and wonder, hey, I wonder what else they're doing in Star Wars.
That's a good point.
There's no side. Remember, like, what was that? Splinter of the Mind's Eye, whatever that book was, that Star Wars book.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They were, oh my God, a side story.
Yeah.
And more story with Guardians. There's a ferociousness of people wanting more.
Do you think it's because
that
because the property itself was not as well known?
I think that has a lot to do with it.
No, it does have a lot to do with
people
it.
People are like discovering a new thing.
It's a Star Wars to them.
And it's almost kind of like, you know, oh, you know, Avengers, that's my parents, you know, like my parents' superhero is Iron Man, or, you know, but it's like this Guardians, the kids, they haven't heard, oh, this seems like a whole new thing. And then also just James's sense of humor.
And the fact
that he hired funny, cool people to be in the movie. It's just like, there's so many things about it that just connected at the same time.
It's fascinating. There's levels that I get to feel.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. Like, oh, this one. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't wait to... I love that was such a home run, because I feel like so much... There was so much... there were so many eyes on that in particular of, you know, I mean, like a property that most people had never heard of before. And can you make a big movie? And it's, you know, because it flies in the face of the classic thing that, that the entertainment business always says, which is, well, let's just reboot stuff or let's make, you know, because people need stuff they recognize. Like, they didn't recognize anything about this movie. They just made a good movie and people went and saw it.
The Marvel logo got people's attention, but it's got to deliver for sure. And when they'd earned trust with the logo, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it had to deliver. I'm part of the Marvel Creative Committee, which is we consult on all the movies. So we read every draft of everything
as
they come in. And one of the ones that since the earliest germ of kernel of an outline all the way through to the final edit, Guardians was fascinating.
Yeah.
That one was, is this a movie? It really was like we're reading it. Is it a movie?
Yeah.
They could just go make Iron Man 4. It'd be fine.
Yeah.
You know, but I love that they went.
Are you still reading drafts of Ant-Man? What's going on?
No, we're past Ant-Man.
Oh, good. No, I know. The script took so long, it seems.
I read a lot of drafts of Ant-Man. Uh-huh. I was, because that was very early. So that went on for years.
Yeah.
And not every single week, but like, Every few months, I'm like, boom, it's another Ant-Man draft. I'm like, there's another Ant-Man draft. And then, but we're working on stuff that you haven't heard of yet or.
There's a fourth phase?
Yeah. There's a lot of cool stuff coming.
That's awesome.
Civil War is next, and that's a lot of fun to read.
I can't wait.
Marcus and McFeely, and they're really good writers, and they're fun to read writers. So that's
true. There are writers who are not fun to read, and there are some
fun to read. Joss is really fun to read. You ever read a Joss Whedon script or an Aaron Sorkin script? They're just fun to read. But there's other things when it's a fine script. It's just not it's Joss.
You're just turning the page to get. You're just trying to get through it.
Yeah.
And when you have when someone who writes fun, you realize you're
80 pages in and you didn't even notice. Yeah. That's a great script. That's a lot of fun to read.
If you're not. What do you do when I always like to ask writers this question? What do you do when you're stuck and you hit the wall and you're like, I don't want to write another panel of anything, but I have to because I have a deadline. And
it's a mix of neuroses, obsessive compulsive, something my mother said when I was a kid. I don't know, but I don't get writer's block. But the reason I write so many different titles at once is because, all right, if the Spider-Man well's dry, I'll just do Guardians. You know what I mean? Or if I go take a shower and all of a sudden this line of dialogue I've been searching for 2 years finds its way, I'm doing Powers. I thought I was going to do that today. I'm going to do this today. So I create a situation where it's almost impossible to have total writer's block.
Yeah.
I'm working in 4 different genres at once. So whatever mood I'm in.
Do you ever keep, like, sometimes what I do if I'm working on a bunch of stuff at once is I will keep all the documents open on my desktop.
I do. I have six or seven scripts.
I click back and forth, and that's the best. That's my advice to anybody out there.
No, I just leave the files open just to remind me. You got more shit to do, man. So just don't, you know.
I bounce. I bounce back and forth.
I don't bounce. Oh. I'll get into the zone, and then I'll suddenly stop and be in another zone. But, you know what I found? I found because Powers is out and we're done on our work on the season. So it was like the Powers folder was a big mess. It was just like, it was like all documents and outlines. And so I was arranging all the Powers stuff and was mixing with all the comic book stuff. So I was putting everything away in these little folders. And I came across a file from 2004 that said Powers Murder Ideas. And I opened it and it was literally like 25 things I thought of that I just wrote down while they were in my head. And 90% of them were solid. Like I was like, it was like a time capsule.
Go you.
I almost started to cry. I'm like, they were good for the show or the book. I was like,
hey, future Brian, I have a present for you.
Really? It's like, I never had that experience before. Like, usually I'll see some old file open up and go, there's a reason I didn't follow that.
It's 2.5 more seasons, PlayStation. You hear that?
Yeah, I know. I couldn't believe it. I've never had that experience before.
That's awesome.
It literally, like, and I don't remember writing them. I have no recollection of making the file.
That's why it's good to write down every fucking idea. You will always forget them if you don't write them down.
You write them down the second you think of them. Even, 10 years later, I'm like, phew.
Because, you know, what you learn, I think what you learn is that sometimes your brain's not ready to flesh out an idea. So if you have a nugget of something, you might have to live for a few years before it contextually makes sense, like before you have the right resources to draw it out.
Yeah, and I've learned like everything to its own time. Like everything will find its time. And even when you put it out and you realize, oh, this wasn't the time, I shouldn't put this out. But you know, your brain will tell you when it's time.
Yeah.
Yeah, at least it's time for you to work it out, yeah.
So you started in crime.
Started in crime, yeah. I just fell in love with the look of film noir. Some of it has to do with I have a eye issue called keratoconus, which makes light very interesting in my world.
Really?
And, yeah. And I just like heavy shadows. I see the world in heavy I see things like Gordon Willis lit them. And it's true. And
that's kind of awesome.
It is. And originally I just thought that's what the world looked. And then, I have a problem. But it's like your corneas are shaped like a football a little bit. They're like protrude out. I have like, you can see a giant contact takes over my
eye. Yeah.
It masses it down so I can see like a person. But without it, looks like I'm looking through a Coke bottle.
Oh my gosh.
With heavy noir shadows. But I was so taken to John Alton and Gordon Willis and all these because of it. And I learning the rules of film noir just drove me nuts. And that was like the 90s in total for me. Yeah.
Wow. They're using a disability to it.
I didn't know it at the time. Afterwards, I went, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Were you just with someone one day like, you know how the world is draped in shadows? Like, no.
No, I was somewhere and a light just my eyes saw just like streams of light coming off of it. And I went, J.J. Abrams hasn't even directed a movie. How am I seeing this? And I went and checked it out. I'm like, maybe I can't see so well. And it was fixable. It's fixable, but I'm fine.
Lens flares. I just don't.
You're not a lens flare.
The movie makes me happy because I see every movie looks like that.
That's fantastic for you. But I mean, it just takes. It's just a reminder that you're looking through a lens of something.
Anyway. Conrad Hall fan, so it doesn't bother me.
You know, it's that too, and then also it's when there's a blood splatter and you see it hit the lens too.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like on other stuff too. But I can never decide if it takes me out of it or if I think it's because it does help convey the idea. Like if that was your perspective, if you were there, you would get blood on your face. Yeah.
There's a great movie that I actually show in class called Visions of Light. It was made by the American Cinematographers Institute, and it's an amazing documentary on cinematography, which is how to tell pictures with how to tell stories with pictures. And in it, they focus on all the great cinematographers. And the first person to ever put a movie out that had the lens flare on it was Conrad Hall in a Western, and he had the light hit the lens and it flared. And normally the studio would go, oh, you have to go back and reshoot that. There's a mistake. And he went, yeah, but doesn't it make it look hot? Doesn't it make it look like the sun's beating down? And it was the first time that mistake became like a valid choice of storytelling.
Oh, so, wow.
The history of the lens flare.
Yeah, that's
nerds.
Yeah. A little accidental. Yeah. Do they show a Koyaanisqatsi?
What's that from?
Koyaanisqatsi?
What's that from?
It's just this movie. How would you describe Koyaanisqatsi? It's basically like this weird cinematic cross-cultural. There's no dialogue in
it. Philip Glass does the soundtrack, and it's a lot of like fast motion pieces.
Oh, I've never heard that word said out loud. I know what you're talking. I've seen the letters.
I think they even say it in the movie too when they're going
Koyaanisqatsi.
Swear to God, I've never heard that word out loud.
Koyaanisqatsi.
You have seen it.
I'm so upset. I didn't know something.
Moving.
Did someone die on a keyboard? And all these letters just what he was writing was Koyaanisqatsi. I guess when he passed away. Yeah, there's a couple of them, but that's a movie that
there's three.
And you really can sort of without narcotics just trip out to it
a little bit.
The same time you see it on a big screen. Funny. It is is that how you would describe comics as telling stories with pictures or what?
Well, yeah, it's a visual medium. So, and some writers make that mistake. They lean onto their hard work of a writer, writerly writer, but you're supposed to be writing for your artist or for yourself, the artist, to tell the story as clearly as possible.
Right.
So, you know, when people write their scripts, they forget it's a letter to your collaborators. That's all it is. And in film, that it's hundreds of people, so it's very structured. And but for in comics, it might be one other person. It might be just you. It might be total. It's five people. Yeah. Like it's never more than your editor, the colorist, the letterer, you know, all that. So I focus on that. Like, what your job is to write things that your artists will want to draw and will be inspired to draw. Yeah, on the best day, you're giving them stuff that just. Brings out the best version of themselves.
I know it's slightly different medium, but John Kay always had this notion that that animation shouldn't over. He said basically, if you can shut your eyes and know exactly what's going on, that's animated radio, which is not what a cartoon should be.
Yeah, it's the Ricky Gervais show on HBO. Yeah, you don't need to watch it, but it's great.
But it's hilarious. Yeah. Do you find that it's the same thing with comics, that you feel like it you shouldn't be able to know exactly what's going on just by reading
it? It's opposite. You should be able to, on some level, be able. They said the perfect comic book page, you don't need any words on it. That you can tell what's happening just from the storytelling, and that's also just a great artist at the height of picking the right camera angles for every. Piece. Yeah. Yeah. So you look like Jack Kirby, original artwork. You don't know what's happening, but you know what's happening immediately just by looking at it.
Do you ever do weird personal challenges where you're like, I'm only going to write X amount of dialogue in this particular issue just to see?
Yeah, I've done silent issues. I've done, prose. I play with that a lot. It does upset some people. That's a lot of words. My letterer is ready to come. But I try different things because I'm interested in different things. I grew up Howard Chaykin and P. Craig Russell, and they would try different stuff, and they would break up the pages in a different way. It was exciting to me. I got excited. So I try it where I can. And sometimes you try it in a mainstream book that has not had a history of that, and it does throw people because they're just not used to it. But, sometimes that's the stuff you remember the most.
How fucking lucky are these kids that they get you as a teacher, like a guy who is a legit working...
I'll tell you a thing, but I started doing it. Diana Schutz, who is the executive editor of Dark Horse Comics, who had been teaching for a lot of years, and she would have me come in and guest lecture. And I would truly love it. I would love it. And when Portland State was looking to get this set up, she knew I had like four kids and eight full-time jobs. And she goes, bully him into doing it. He should do it. And I'm thrilled glad she did, because it's very fulfilling. And it forces me as a writer to stay at the basics, because mm-hmm. you're teaching basics.
Yeah.
And that a lot of times when you're off being super clever, you throw them out the window to the adverse of your story. It just screws up the story that you forgot your act break. Having the basics in front of me all the time has been very helpful in this stage of my life. And it's exciting when one of your students finds their way. I had a couple of students already make a name for themselves, and it's, I take full credit for it. All of it. But I do. I absolutely love it. And I also said, boy, would I have loved, and this goes back to buying a book that you would you buy this book if your name wasn't on it?
Right.
When I was coming up, and you're talking about my TED Talks about this too, I wanted someone to teach this class. This is the class I wanted. I wanted someone to sit down and here's everything, figure it out, right? And so it had to go with that philosophy. I would want this class, and I have to teach it. And I'm this position where I can get everyone to come in, Greg Rucka and Matt Fraction and Kelly Sue, and come in and give them the Glengarry Glenn Ross speech every week. Absolutely.
Caddies are for closers.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm so glad I did. And then it brought me to doing the book, and I'm so glad I did that too, because it just we're in our comics community is global now. It's global, so I hear from everyone all the time, day and night. And these are the questions I get all day.
Well, sharing knowledge is like the. I think it's one of the most important things that you can do, rather than everyone has like probably little tricks.
But the comics is historically people don't share. They feel
right.
What we found, like not my generation at all, but the generation like in the 80s. Like they would never share their there was an interview where someone asked John Byrne about process, and he wouldn't answer it. And it really felt like, do you think like we're going to see through you? I mean, you like we, you know, like they're scared they're going to be found out or something. Right. My generation completely abandoned that. We're like, share.
Yeah, because everyone's going to bring their own thing to it. It's like Gordon Ramsay can tell you how to make a cake, but it's not going to be exactly like Gordon Ramsay's cake. Like, you're going
to he's not a baker. You'd probably want to listen to someone else.
But it is a thing that people immediately assume. They think I'm teaching a how to write like me class, and
right.
I couldn't be less interested in that. First of all, it's kind of my thing,
right?
And I don't need the competition,
right?
Writing like me, so it's not. I don't want that. I want you. You're on a path, and I want to help you, you know, figure out the most out of your path.
That's the thing is teaching people not here do X and then Y. It's fine, you know. Here's how you can find your own voice. There's certain questions you can ask yourself, or things, exercises that you can do to keep expressing who you are and find out who that person is. And you might have influences at some point, and you might start off copying someone. You know, in my case, it was like, oh, I'd start off trying to copy Chuck Jones, which is very hard.
But in broadcasting, who do you think you were influenced by?
Oh, interesting. Broadcasting, Carson. Mm-hmm. Greg Kinnear, to an extent.
I can see the Kinnear.
Kinnear was really Letterman for sure. Before he got cranky, and Carson.
But at least he's self-aware cranky. It's not like he's cranky, doesn't know it.
I like a cranky Dave Letterman.
You like a cranky Letterman. Yeah.
We're about to see, I think, the next 6 months of him just telling everyone what he really thinks of them. I think we're about a week away from him going. Every guest is going to be like, I never liked you. you don't smell good. Remember the one that Letterman Paris Hilton have.
Yeah,
he's in there. He's waiting to come out. He's got nothing left to lose.
It's very true. And I think – I wonder if it's even sunk in yet that it's – I mean, he's what? A month and a half away? 6 weeks away?
Is it that far away?
I thought it was farther. I think April is – well, Steven's not taking over for a little while.
Until September, I think.
But I think they stopped doing first run episodes like around April, and then they'll just.
Oh, let me ask you. So, when do you start on The Daily Show?
I'm not doing over there? The Daily Show.
See what
show.
I did?
Listen, that's a very sweet thing for you to say. I personally would suck at The Daily Show.
Oh,
I just, you know what it is? I don't have a passion for politics.
Oh, that's okay. That I can.
And you know, I mean.
If it was me, I'd just be screaming at the camera, like, we're all burning!
What's gonna happen? Can you believe what this fucking guy said?
This isn't funny.
Hey, fucking guy, take a cyanide pill on camera.
I hope to God they do guest host weeks and we get to do one with you. I would love to see you just screaming into the camera.
I don't know. How did John do this for 15 years?
Is it time for the guest? Is it time for the guest?
Bring Kilborn back.
Yeah, this isn't funny.
This isn't funny. Yeah, this guy said that and this guy said that.
Did you guys see The Walking Dead? That was 3 days ago.
Not as scary as what's really happening in the world. Not as scary. Yeah. The Daily Show is and also who wants to follow John? Like, it's like,
no, it is. Yeah, that's the showbiz.
You're just not. Yeah. I mean, you know, when John followed Kilborn, I'm sure there was a little bit of waves, but it's not like Craig had only been on the show for a few years,
so he wasn't like. You know, it was. I watched the show.
Right.
It was snarky and fun, but it did not hit a level. You know, that John had hit.
And John also had the luxury of being in a pre-social media era where not everything he did was under a microscope, and he was allowed the freedom to find it.
Sure.
You know, and then he found it pretty quickly. But
he also had a couple of shows to start. I mean, he needed a lot of practice.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I mean, I think mechanically I could do it for sure, because I've hosted shows for 21 years, and I know how to get into the DNA. I know how to get into the molecules of a show, but I think it's really important that you have the passion for your source material.
I mean, I'm not joking. I don't think Fox News is funny. I don't think it's funny at all. I think it's scary shit.
It is scary.
And I would have a hard time every day coming up with an angle.
I mean, like 5 days a week.
Yeah, to laugh.
Or four
at
to
it.
4 days a week.
Not to quote John Cleese again, but I actually wrote a story about this in a comic book years ago. But he was he did a book with his therapist, and they were talking about how when you're young, everything's hilarious because it's just, you know, anarchy. It's, you know, fuck them and fuck this, and then when you get older, you realize it's never going to change. And it's not funny anymore.
Was this the most recent book that he did about his mom?
No. This is like 20 years ago.
He talked about it on our show.
Yeah.
But this book rattled me, because you talk about, you get to a certain age and you realize the world's fucked and it's not funny. and no one's changing, no one's helping, and no one's changing it. And that's when you stop writing jokes. I'm like, oh.
And that's why old people get grumpy.
Oh, my God. But I was like, oh, my, oh, holy shit. That's really upsetting. I was like in my 20s when I read it, and I was like, oh. That really bothered me.
You goddamn kids.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think part of what makes that happen is when you're young, you're most of your actions are fueled by this sex fog.
Yeah,
you're supercharged up, and you're just, you know. And then
no, but you're also like, "Fuck you! Yeah. I'm here. Guess who's here?
Yeah,
me. I'm here, and I'm going to make it better."
You're ready to supplant the current ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you finally become the ruling class, it's the fog is gone, and you're tired.
No, it's okay over here. That's all right.
No, this is fine now. Yeah, we're not there yet. I'm just saying it will happen at some point.
No, I mean when you get to
right.
You're like, all right, that's fine.
Yeah, but I do think it's a, you know, and maybe that's where Letterman's at now, where he's like, there's nothing funny.
No, that story he told when he announced he was going off the air.
No,
he said that he. Him and his kid had gone fishing, and that they found a fish, and they couldn't find the name of the fish. And all day long at work, he was trying to find the fish, like on the internet. And they finally found the fish. He was so excited, he ran home to tell his son he found the fish. And he went to his wife and went, "We found the fish. We found the fish." He goes, "Who was on the show tonight?" He goes, "Yeah, I don't remember. I probably should quit." Like, I'm like all into this fish, and I could give a shit who I just interviewed. He told this story on the air. I'm like, why? He goes, maybe it's time for me to go.
Like, but I think there was also an internal clock in his brain when Jay was gone. He was like, all right. Yeah. And then it was just like a kitchen timer. Tick, 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 tick. Before
that, and he also said, him and if you get a chance on YouTube, him and Seinfeld did a roundtable together. It's really great. It's like an hour of them just really talking shop. And he pretty much said, oh, fucking Jimmy Fallon's going to sing and dance and he can do anything. I got to do all that shit now. I'm out of here.
I mean, the tectonic plate shifting in late night is pretty unprecedented now.
It's amazing. Everyone's gone. Yeah.
Yeah. With Jay going and Jimmy coming in and Seth moving into Jimmy's slot and John leaving and Stephen going over to Dave and Larry coming in
and
after
Craig.
John and Craig. Craig leaving and Corden coming in. I mean, it's just such a... It is a and us starting a year and a half ago, like it's just sort of.
And you guys are in, right?
We are
good, right?
Tucked away nicely at midnight.
That's good.
We have no 11:30 show to compete with. We have no 12:30 show to compete with.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's fun. I think, you know, at midnight really is my dream show. It's every element of a show that I would ever want to do. So
that's cool.
I was never offered the Late Late Show. That was never anything that even came up. But had it been offered to me, I can honestly say I wouldn't have taken it. Because I'm like, no, I already got a show up and running. That's very hard to do.
Oh, happy God. I thought you were going to say that before you got At Midnight going, they were going to offer you and you were saying no.
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 No, no, no. Before, yeah. Okay. Of course, I would have taken it.
Yes.
But now, you know, it's a very difficult format to innovate. Because there are certain conventions and, you know, fucking Jimmy did it. Like, he accessed every facet of his personality. And, you know, At Midnight's very refillable every night because the comics keep it. The games change and the comics change. But that guy has to fucking tap dance and do karaoke every fucking night. I don't know how he does it.
Yeah, hey, what's a giant version of a game you played at home?
Just like a complete fucking dork, I just emailed him the other night. I'm like, I don't know how you do it every night. I think it's an amazing job, and you've completely turned the show around and made it your own, and I think that's incredible.
Jerry Seinfeld said something. I'm very excited that you're a hit. He said this to Jimmy Fallon. He goes, now we get to find out what weird sex thing you're into. It might take 30 years, but we're going to find out. Find out what weird shit you do.
Oh, I think everyone goes a little crazy. I think
he goes, you're now in prison and you're about to go nuts because you can't leave here.
Right.
This is it for 30 years. You're stuck here. You're going to do something weird in that office and we're all going to find out.
It's kind of like radio guys too. Like when you do the same thing, you know, when you have to do the same job every day for like 30 years and you can't really miss it and you got to be there and you always have to be on.
I think you do a great job at midnight of sort of like, processing the show and then whoop, let's do another one.
Yeah.
Just sort of like,
I'm excited to come to work every day. There's not one day where I go, oh man, I can't believe I got to go in and do
because we've been fortunate.
My
enough for
worst
every...
day, I'm writing comic books for a living and supporting my family. How bad of a day.
Yeah. How bad of a day.
It really sucks the whiny shit out of me. Which
I mean,
my natural state is the whiny shit. So.
Also lucky. We really left the house this morning
lucky,
and I just said as I was walking out the doors, like, Well, gonna go get paid to write dick jokes.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's,
I literally said that sentence.
No, it's like, know, we all have friends with real jobs, with real jobs, and like, woo.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people are like, wow, you work a lot of hours. I'm like, hey, it's, I'm not lifting boxes. Yeah. I'm sitting there wondering who would win in a fight.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you go back and you were to write a letter as your 13-year-old self about all the things that you would want to do,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's a, you've I'm sure you far exceeded all the expectations that you had.
Way, I had a goal, and I'm way past.
So let me ask you this then: this could be an interesting question. Is you know, it, once you go through the ceiling, and you sort of have those ideas of like, well, once I do this, I've made it, and then you do that, and I would imagine in your case it happened fairly quickly. You don't think so?
No, the feeling of you made it does not
exist.
There's every once in a while you look at something and go, well, I have to consciously acknowledge that this happened. You know what I mean? Like, Will Eisner handed me an award.
You have, like, five Eisner awards?
Yeah. He shook my hand and handed me an award. Acknowledge that something nice happened.
Right.
But I'm just not wired to bask in it on any level.
Right.
Not, no.
And not that you... I mean, I think it's good to take those moments and appreciate them.
Yeah.
But you can't...
But it's hard to... Like, I had to teach myself that, and thank God I married the right person that helps you with that, who points and goes, that was good. I'm like, you're right, that was good.
Well, because, you know, in the business that when and I assume it's the same in yours, especially because you are a workhorse, as am I, but you get so used to getting into putting out fires mode,
mm-hmm.
that when there aren't fires, you start being like, do I need to build a fire? Because I got to put out a fire. I mean, like,
no, I can make a fire in 2 seconds.
I can make a fire, no problem.
Like, you know, listen, a fire is just one tweet away. I can upset 80,000 X-Men fans.
Well, you have a forum.
That.
You have a forum too. Like
my forum's gone. I shut the
you
forum
got rid
down.
Of it.
I used Tumblr instead. I found the forum was up for like 22 years. We were a good,
Jinx World.
Yeah, we were good. That was a really good environment. But I found myself gravitating to Tumblr more. I just liked it more, and eventually just said, I'm going to like lean it all here. Mm-hmm. And just you put up artwork that inspires you. You put up, like, I get so excited, like a new cover comes in, I get to put it up and talk about it, and I just like the conversation more. But
yeah.
That, and Twitter kind of ruined message boards because,
sure.
you know, but it was a great, great, great conversation place, and the community was fantastic. We had marriages. We had babies, out of the marriage. People met on the board, they got married, had babies.
Wow.
I was immensely proud of that, yeah.
I mean, that's really, you know, all those things, the way that that the stuff that you create trickles down, and, like, that's part of the DNA that's being passed on in a weird sort of way. Your seed is inside.
Yeah, and this goes back to something you said earlier, too. It's you know, people discover you at a certain time in your career, and then they stay with you. And that is an amazing thing. That is you've had that too. Like people, you've gone from project to project, and you're like, oh, that dude's still with me. That's awesome, right? And it's so special to me. It really, it's so special. And then for other people, you're like that band that breaks. And like, you remember when R.E.M. broke and I pissed off all the R.E.M. fans?
Oh, man, they were so mad. Yeah, when that one, when Losing My Religion came out and won.
Furious.
And Tarsim directed the music video and they won all the awards and they were fucking huge and all the
you
people.
You used to be great.
What happened to Radio Free Europe, man?
You guys suck now. And
yeah, everybody hurts. I fucking hurt.
And I was like, I remember that happening and thinking, I can't wait for that to happen to me. I would love someone to tell me, sell out. I was like, please. Let it be. So when it happened, I was really excited. But it's just the comics community has always there's an interaction that was very unique up until Twitter when everyone can yell at any celebrity. The only place you could really interact with people who did it for a living was comics or country music. You can go to country music, used to have a convention. You could do that too. But if you can talk to any comics author that you like. And they're there to talk to you, and it's a wonderful thing. It's absolutely – people like to be inside and you know, see what's going on. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, well, when I was growing up in a pre-internet era, it's exactly what you said where the community was basically – there were like five kids in my whole school that were into the same stuff that I was into, and that was sort of our common – it's like we all sort of got scraped into this bin.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you wanted to connect with people beyond that, you either had to go to a Comic-Con or a comic book shop.
Or the comic buyer's letter column. That would be the place where you felt like there was a community. And it was not a pretty place. So.
But now, do you... Is Scab having a bad dream?
Yeah. Okay.
Scout is the sweetest.
Is he ever going to stop talking about himself? Oh my god! My dogs do that when they. You know, so.
Just having nightmares.
Shut up about Miles Morales.
Twitter.
He's just having a dream where we're just podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wakes up.
I have two dogs that literally sit there while I do my thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the little bunny legs running.
Oh, that's sweet.
Chasing bunnies, yep.
What's your setup have to be? Like, what implements and things have to be in place?
I pride myself, and I do preach this, that you should be able to do whatever you do for a living. You should be able to do it anywhere with any pen, any piece of paper, any, you know what I mean? A lot of people go, I can't draw, I don't have my pen. I've seen Alex Ross pull out a ballpoint pen and blow the roof off the place. I've seen Alex Maleev do it. If you can do it, you can do it with anything. In fact, I've seen friends poke their finger and bleed all over it and made some cool, like Kent Williams-y cool shit, you know? And so I'm the same way. If I have something to write, you know, the phone makes it easy too. You can just start taking notes and stuff like that. But in my house, I have a very cool 60s Japanese architect table that I found at a garage sale that my wife had refurbished. It's the coolest desk. Nice. I really love this thing. And I'm there. I got all my stuff there, and you know, the castle of nerd that I built.
Yes.
And every couple of weeks I buy an IDW artist edition, and it's another brick into the tomb that they're going to seal me in. And that's that. So. Yeah, you know, they got the comics and the figures and the, you know, whatever. So, yeah.
Do you ever have to purge? Do you have to go, okay, I collected a bunch of this and I really need to, or do you move it to, do you have a storage?
I rearrange. The hardest part about writing all the stuff I do is that the comps build up. Like, I get free copies of everything, and then, which was the whole point of my life, was to get free comics. So it's awesome, but then you have to find, you know, you don't want to throw them away or anything. You want to find good homes and charities and stuff for them. So,
yeah. Is comic book collecting now, is it still, I mean, when I was younger, I feel like it was a thing not everyone was doing, and so there are a lot of things that are more special now, but now that's much more ubiquitous, or is the digital era going to make them more valuable?
Well, I have feelings about this. A lot of friends of ours will have nostalgic feelings about hunting for an issue. Mm-hmm. They could never, you don't have to hunt anymore. If you really want it, yeah, someone's selling it on Amazon. The hunt would take you all across the country. Like I will find this issue of Avengers if it kills me, right? And so that is gone. I never quite cared for it, to be honest with you. I want when I want when I want it.
Right.
And so what I'm grateful for in the time that I've been making comics is that in the early days, like I'll say Powers as an example. In the early days of Powers, I would get emails or letters, I can't find it. There's nowhere to get it. No one here is selling it. And I would literally try to sell them by hand, you know. But over the course of the years, thank God for everything, no one asks that anymore. They know you can get it one way or another. Yeah. You can get anything, and they do. And I was talking to my friends, like, isn't that nice? Because that's all you want, is you want people to have your stuff when they want it.
Yeah.
And when you're an independent guy, it was frustrating because people wanted it. They were reaching out to you to tell you how badly they wanted it.
And they can't get it.
And they couldn't get it. And it was like, oh. And you think in your head, you've decided, for every one person that reaches out, there's 1,000 more lost souls waiting to make me a successful author, and the system is failing me. And But I truthfully love... that you can get whatever you want. Like today, Powers came out today on television, and boom, here's the link. Boom, I love it. How great is that?
Yeah. I love to. I mean, and also, it's very convenient not having to carry a stack of things and just be able to just go to Comixology. Like, okay, I'll buy this, and I'm ready to fly. I'm ready to get on a plane.
Yeah, and I people ask you, do you care if it's digital? I don't care if someone projected it on a wall and that's how you read it. I just read it. You know, format is not, it doesn't matter to me.
Did they make any comment in either direction whether or not the Spider-Man coming back to the Marvel Universe is it going to be Miles, or is it
going to... Well, I'm going to change the subject and answer your last question.
God damn it!
You know what's cool when you get to do this for a living? Everything becomes next level. Like collecting comics for me,
yes,
becomes, instead of hunting down Walt Simonson comics or an Art Adams comic, I actually just did an issue of Guardians of the Galaxy with Art Adams. So that's... so I'm actually, you know...
That's a whole...
And he was... he killed it. It was like the best thing he's done in 10 years. And I've worked with Howard Chaykin, and I've worked with Alan Davis, and that was a really pleasure in there. And me and Klaus Janson and Bill Sienkiewicz and David Mack did a Daredevil run together. I'm like, yeah, so it's so that you realize you're not doing it like consciously, but then you realize you're now collecting.
You're collecting real dudes.
Humans. Yeah. You're collecting humans. And, but that's cool. And then working on the Marvel movies, like I get to read them and see them before all of my friends. And isn't that the point?
That everything. Really is the point, because then you can lord that over them, because it makes you a little bit better than they
it's
are.
It's even better. I'm not allowed to even tell them I've seen it. So I'll have like, we'll have people over for dinner, and lo and behold, because we're nerds, they'll be. I'll talk about, I wonder which Spider-Man
right.
is going to show up in the Marvel Universe, and they'll look at me and I'll go, because I'm not allowed to say anything. And so, and that's even better, because it's, I'm not being a dick. I'm not allowed to say, but it's a dick move.
It is. It yeah. is. So I'm just saying Donald Glover would be great. I'm sure you haven't heard that before, but you know.
I love him. We they cast him as the voice of Miles in the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon on Disney XD, and he killed it. Yeah. So that we felt.
I mean, are we going to see a white-tailed spider or a brown recluse?
So we are going to. I'm not allowed to talk about anything Spider-Man related, but okay. What I know is very, very cool.
Oh, good.
I was really happy with what I've been shown.
I think you'll find the truth serum that was placed into your water is quite inescapable.
This time, he's a Hasidic Jew.
You understand the powers of
Spider-Man.
The Marvel Comics non-disclosure agreement.
Mm-mm, no,
can,
what?
It
Spider-Man?
Can
Spider-Man?
Completely
it's not,
outperform.
They're probably pretty cool
serum.
With that, right? They're probably cool with these.
No, what's his face? The
Disney
best,
can't lawyer up.
I think Sam Jackson, I think he was on the talk show, and he said something. If I say one more word, you're going to see like a red dot on my head. This is, you know.
And then you're going to see a Goofy on a red tower going,
Exactly.
Take the shot.
And then Darth Vader standing over them both.
No, it's cool. And that job particularly, mixing in the teaching on Friday and then adding in the, just watching these great writers and directors work their process over these characters that we all love and just watch them make their choices. It's, you know, it's like basics and advanced, you know, watching Joss Whedon make his choices and then seeing how they all plan out.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And it's made me a tremendous, it's helped me tremendously.
Well, I'm glad that these two storytelling words aren't segregated anymore, that everything is starting to.
It's all story. It's all telling a story. It's all people want to escape their shit for 20 minutes and. Our job is to do that. So
your book, Brian Michael Bendis, Words for Pictures, The Art and Business of Writing Comics and Graphic Novels, is available now.
Now. It's from Random House 10 Speed Press. It's on Amazon Kindle. It's on the. It's in the bookstores. Barnes & Noble's been carrying them very
select
nice.
Select University bookstores in Portland.
Yes. Well, no, they're sold out there.
Smells great.
Yeah, it's got many, many, many of the greatest artists and editors and writers of comics sharing their philosophies and opinions and artwork that you've never seen before. The two best chapters in there were almost like a throwaway. One is an artist roundtable and one is an editor's roundtable. And they are asked the same five questions. And the answers were surprising to myself and to everyone in comics who read them, which is, do you like full script or do you like Marvel style? What is the worst thing a writer ever did to you? And their answers their answers changed me as a writer. Like I changed my shit when I read it.
Well, I hope that you periodically take some time to look back and go, hey, actually, I've done some pretty cool shit. And
I finally got on this damn podcast.
You finally got
finally
on the podcast.
Finally crawled my way into the nerd podcast.
If I knew you were an Oregonian, we could have done the. I go to Portland a handful of times a year.
You could fill a year's worth of podcasts by coming to Portland. You can get your shit done like. In a weekend.
And then just take a break.
You could do it like they do. They do a Wheel of Fortune. Just film a bunch and then go play golf for 6 months.
We are so close to being on the Sajak schedule. It is not even funny.
Seriously, there is fascinating, amazing people.
He's
Polinek. You could just on and on and on.
Side note, Sajak's going to melt down big time on television at some point.
Oh, for sure. Oh, absolutely.
He
kind of has already.
You see like... You see, like, bolts popping out of the dam.
But they took his Twitter away, so, you know. What he tweeted something nuts,
He's tweeted some crazy stuff.
Yeah, he's tweeted
some crazy stuff.
He's about, like, just turn the letters and shush.
I think it's a game show host thing. They all get a little...
You know what it is? I think it's doing, I think it's having to be this persona.
Hey, there's nothing real here
decades,
at all.
For decades. Like, the only person that seemed like it didn't kind of fuck him up too much was Bob Barker. Like, he seemed he seemed kind of okay, right?
All he's thinking about is spading and neutering my pets.
Yeah, he just wants to make sure your pets don't impregnate each other. He just wants to cut off the balls.
He's thinking about
of your
animal
pets.
Junk a lot while he's at work.
Yeah.
I never think about it that much at work.
He, anyway. And then, you know, I think, who was I talking to that, God, someone who was on the podcast was talking about when Carson quit, like, that was it. He just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Just didn't. Yep. Didn't crave it anymore. No. Didn't have to, you know.
Fascinating.
Night after.
Did you ever
night.
Watch that American Masters show on him
on PBS
on Carson?
Yeah, it really was fascinating. But I think it didn't even delve as far as it could have gone. But there were definitely traces of, you know, that I think if he liked you, he was probably pretty cool. But he was also, I think it was one of those things like, I don't know if anyone ever really knew Johnny. And I don't think he was.
I worry about Letterman when he gets off the air, just like.
You know what, though? The reason I'm not worried about Letterman is because he's got a kid, right?
Letterman so is that'll... going to fuck everything that moves when he gets off the air. Letterman is going to go on a tear that they're going to wake up. Bill Carter's going to have a whole other book on his hands.
Great last show. Did I just get fucked? Like, someone's going to. That's the one show.
He had Stern talked about this. Letterman had to close his sex room at work. He had a room for sex, and they took it away from him. Sorry, what's going on over there?
Well, any room can be a sex room. I mean,
he had a room specifically.
If you're really, I know, but it's just like what you said. If you're really good at it, you can do it anywhere. Oh, I didn't.
True. You
I didn't,
brought it all home.
I didn't bring my dick. I'm sorry. I didn't bring my. You could fuck with any dick. I saw Alex Ross fuck with a ballpoint pen.
Alex Maleev. Anyway,
Brian, it's good to see you, man. Thank you so much for coming.
Don't forget to watch Powers.
Yeah, don't forget to watch Powers.
PlayStation.com/Powers. It's there. You don't need a PlayStation to watch it.
But if you have a PlayStation, you can watch it on that.
Watch it on the PlayStation. If you got PlayStation Plus account, it is free.
Fantastic.
So many, many, many people have that.
I believe
it's just,
I do.
It's got a free thing. It will therefore be free to me.
Guys, I'm not paying shit for this. Besides
cool.
what I already paid for.
No, I'm excited. By the way, I love that. I love that people who already have it are just getting it.
Yeah.
That makes me happy.
I'm into it.
Yeah, that's cool.
Cool, man. Good
All
to
right,
see
thank
Enjoy
you.
Enjoy your
much.
Burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels.
She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels?
There are murders in all of the books.
That she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.